my pleasure to welcome you, Professor Edward Sway, and we look forward to your talk.
A couple of introductory notes. There was a FAFO study, two Norwegian sociologists who studied the Palestinian society. Basically, they have studied the Islamic background of Muslims in Palestine, and they found, those two sociologists, that most Islamists come from middle class families that are from the city rather than from refugee camps. I had basically the other opinion, I believe for a long time, that people from the refugee camps, because of poverty, because of hardships, must be more oriented towards being Islamists. And there are still, until today, those who think that it's an economic factor. You just, you know, dump money and aid on the region, then all this will disappear. It's not true. They found that more women than men subscribe to the Islamic worldview, including political Islam, and here I'm talking about in the broad. I can discuss later on. About 78% of Palestinian Muslim women subscribe to the Islamic worldview, compared to about 76%. So more women, and this says a lot about Muslim women are forced to do this and forced to do that. It's the numbers speak, and I'm glad that they were Norwegian sociologists like myself, despite my physiognomy. And also they come from very highly educated backgrounds. So it's not that they are illiterate, they are not that. And this is really the case. So I just wanted to share this with you. The other one is about the media and what does the media like. Bishop Riyah, former Bishop Riyah Abul Asal, the Anglican bishop of, former Anglican bishop of Palestine, originally from Nazareth, by the way. Once he, at the turn, at the beginning of the Second Intifada, he thought of having a press conference at the American colony in East Jerusalem because there were tons of journalists. He thought that he might as well just have a press conference there, so he got a hall and everything was prepared except that the journalists who were basking in the sun outside did not enter. So he sent one of his aides to recruit journalists to come to the press conference, and one of them said in a clear-cut statement, he said, "Where is the blood?" They were not interested in basically a bishop having a press conference. They were there to take photographs of people dying, people being shot, people shooting, etc. So this is why the average TV is not interested really in the average person who is having dialogue and trying to reach out and having a moderate message. And moderate messages come from all quarters of the world, including also from Islamists and from traditionalists, and that could be academically we know that this is really the case. And to confirm what Professor Hassan Hanafi said earlier about had there been free elections, then the Islamists would win in all Arab countries. Jihad al-Khazin, a Maronite Christian journalist, a respected journalist in the Arab world, he comes from Lebanon. He wrote an article that was published on the first page of Al-Quds Daily. It's very rare. King Abdullah II made it to the first page. Blair once made it to the first page. But also the Jihad al-Khazin made it to the first page as an article. They don't usually do that. And in that article, he spoke about this, that if we have free elections, then Islamists would win. And I understand why. The background of this region is Islam. It's not political Islam. The background is Islam. And when basically, when we have basically these Islamic movements, they are trying to reestablish something, to regain something, to defend a specific case. It's not, it's not really about, a minor issue here or minor issue there. They have major issues. But in order to pave the way for your questions and comments later on for a discussion, I thought of, because in the media there is the you know, they mentioned CNN yesterday, the, you know, General Jim Jones, he was speaking about the Salafists and the Wahhabis and what have you. And I thought that nobody explains to you, not only in this room, but I think at large people don't explain what Salafism or is. Now, the differences between the various Islamic theological and juridical schools could be attributed to many factors, including the very nature of Arabic. Like every other natural language, the semantic structure of Arabic permits allegorical interpretation. The Quran refers to the existence of verses with allegorical connotations and the problematic possibility of misuse. In chapter 3, verse 7, it is who revealed the book to you. Some of its verses are decisive, muhkamat. They are the basis of the book, and others are allegorical, mutashabihat. Then as far as those in whose heart there is perversity, they follow the path in which which is allegorical, seeking none knows, seeking to mislead and seeking to give it their own interpretation. But none knows this interpretation except Allah. And those who are firmly rooted in knowledge say, we believe in it. It is all from our Lord, and none do mind except those having understanding. The language of the prophetic traditions also allows different opinions as well. In what I consider the most famous example, some companions of the Prophet had different understandings of a specific prophetic statement. In a tradition mentioned in Sahih al-Bukhari, the Prophet asked his companions not to pray the afternoon prayer until they have reached their destination, the grounds of the Jewish tribe of Banu Qurayza. Those who upheld the literal meaning did not pray until they did reach their destination. The other group was worried about the time slot for the afternoon prayer elapsing, it was getting late in the afternoon. They thought that the Prophet's intention was simply to hasten their pace and not to be preoccupied with anything else on the way. This allegorical interpretation made it imperative for them to pray before they reach their destination, because there is a specific time for each prayer. When they returned to Medina, they told the Prophet about their different positions. Neither had he said which one of them was right, nor had he reprimanded anyone. The reason for this is that each group exerted their effort. We call it ijtihad, really, in Arabic, in understanding the hadith, the language of which allowed both positions. Languages do permit differences, but these differences ought not translate into conflict. Working with original texts, depending on one's creativity, will yield a new understanding that might not be always reconciled with previous popular perceptions. While a plurality of interpretations has always existed in Islamic scholarship, this also confirms the 400 years period that Professor Hanafi talked about, but I think that already there were people who basically thought that they could force their position on others. Not every exegesis of the Quran was accepted. In what I described as the Islamic hermeneutical garden, old and new meanings grow, but the garden has fences, and once one is beyond the fence, one will venture into one of the many non-Islamic gardens. The closest of the latter are the hermeneutical gardens of the people of the book. The intra-Abrahamic fence would look like a continuous chain of Venn diagrams. A Salafi gardener nurtures the old meanings and will make sure that the seedlings of the same are cultivated. As for the new meanings, even if they have Islamic genetic codes, weeding. For contrast, a postmodern hermeneutical gardener is egalitarian. She does not recognize the fences, allows every meaning the same chance to grow, only to use a hermeneutical mower that can detect meaning growth. The latter, strictly speaking, is a garden of non-meaning. Murad Hoffman, in Islam the Alternative, explains fundamentalism in terms of the foundations that are found in every religion or ideology. All religions go through development as a response to challenges they face. And as a result, complex systems emerge. When faced by complex, incomprehensible narratives, the general public resorts to the orthodox worldview because it is simpler. And I quote, all religions and ideologies from time to time demonstrate a need to return to the original belief, to rediscover their foundations in the hope that religion, freed of human ballast, may be revitalized and viewed with fresh eyes, in accordance with current problems. Believers become Protestant, attempt to find the young Marx, update Martin Luther's opponent, Thomas Munzer, or, like the self-styled Christian Franz Alt, try to form a new image of Jesus. Fundamentalism, Hoffman concludes, is not only found in Islam. It has always been around. It may be defined as a movement which takes the legal norms, the values and behavioral patterns of original primary Islam as the absolute model for shaping the present. Hoffman realized that literary fundamentalists were denigrated as naive, if not stupid. His opinion is that their approach corresponds to the conclusions of analytical philosophy of language of the best contemporary provenance. The emergence of the Islamic theological schools. There are Quranic verses about God, the literal meaning of which leads to the formation of anthropomorphic attributes of God. The following example speaks of God's hand. Lo, those who swear allegiance unto thee, is addressing Prophet Muhammad, swear allegiance only unto God. The hand of Allah is above their hands. So whosoever breaks his oath breaks it only to his soul's hurt, while whosoever keeps his covenant with Allah, on him will he bestow immense reward. To think of an anthropomorphic hand would be absolutely contrary to the strict monotheistic message of Islam. Every Muslim scholar knows that the Quran negates the possibility of stating anything that stems from human experience about the essence of God. There is nothing whatever like unto him, and basically this is almost the only verse in the Quran that addresses the essence of God. All the other attributes that are stated, like God being merciful, being compassionate, being eternal, being the creator, the sustainer, they do not address the nature of God as we say. Therefore, there was a need to interpret that which appears to be anthropomorphic. Here I'm attempting to explain where orthodoxy shows up. We don't use amongst ourselves the word orthodoxy, but that at one point there was a point in history which could be defined as an orthodox moment. So therefore, there was a need to interpret that which appears to be anthropomorphic in a way that does not contradict the Islamic worldview. The Salafi, hence the name, the Salafi position is neither to attribute anything anthropomorphic nor deny that which God attributed to himself in the Quran. The Salafis would argue that confirming an attribute of God does not entail similarity with his creation, just like confirming the fact that his essence does not resemble anything else. Confirming the attribute, such as the hand, does not confirm its nature. They would argue that the nature of the attribute should not be questioned, distorted, divested of its intended meaning that befits God's majesty, nor resembled to his creation. The Mu'tazilites, and here we talk about the Muslim rationalists, if you will. These are Muslim rational theologians, were at odds with the Salafi school on different accounts, such as the Mu'tazilites' claim of the uncreatedness of the Quran. They insisted on a pure theological oneness of God that ultimately forced them to reduce his attributes and deny their co-eternity with God. The Mu'tazilites agree that God is one and that there is nothing like him. He is neither a body nor substance. He is unlike whatever occurs in the mind or is pictured in the imagination. They rejected anthropomorphism and corporeality. This led them to interpret the relevant verses allegorically. Therefore, as an example, when faced by the following verse, he, meaning God, he said, O Iblis, to Satan, what hindereth thee from falling prostrate before Adam, which I have created with both my hands? And this is the anthropomorphic part, or what could be described as anthropomorphic. Art thou too proud, or art thou of the high exalted? They interpreted God's hand, the Mu'tazilites, as grace. So that's an allegorical interpretation. The Mu'tazilite school struck an alliance with the Abbasid Caliph Al-Ma'mun, and as a result, those who did not subscribe to the uncreateness of the Quran were persecuted. So there were schools of thought, but when the state adopted one specific school of thought, that led to the persecution of the other school. And this must strike resonance, for example, with the history of Christianity. Those who were persecuted include Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal, the founder of the Hanbali school of jurisprudence and one of the earliest prominent scholars of the Salafi school. The link between the Hanbalites and the Salafis is organic. It should be noted that the Mu'tazilite school did not survive to modern times. Another schism in the Muslim world exists between the Shiites and the Sunnites at large. The word Shiite comprises many sects, but in essence they claim a special political role for the offspring of Ali ibn Abi Talib and Fatima, daughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and their descendants. The Shiites believe that the Prophet named Ali to be the first caliph rather than ending up being the fourth one. Over the years, the Shiites developed unique theological and juridical positions. Not all the developments were tolerated by the Sunnis, and some Shiite sects were utterly rejected. The Alawis, for example, divinized Ali, and this created an unbridgeable theological gap. So if we talk about a plurality, this part cannot be within the garden of meaning that I spoke about earlier. The Amman message of July 2005, which I have personally endorsed, considers the followers of 8 legal schools as Muslims. These include the Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi'i, and Hanbali, and 2 Shi'i schools of Islamic jurisprudence, the Ja'fari and the Zaydi, the Ibadi school of Islamic jurisprudence, and the Zahiri, the literalists. It might be spend a minute about the Zahiri. The Regensburg lecture. How many of you are familiar with the Regensburg lecture? Okay, 3.
They may just not know it by name. It's the lecture that the Pope gave that created yes. a kerfuffle here when he quoted a Byzantine emperor.
Yes. Part of that lecture, the Pope Benedictus spoke about or mentioned also one Muslim scholar only, Ibn Hazm. In fact, there was a mistake. Rather than Ibn Hazm, he was Ibn Hazm. But that's it's a minor mistake, but academics pick up these one-letter mistakes. And he basically made Ibn Hazm as a representative of the 1400 years of Islamic scholarship. that's a serious thing. You cannot reduce Islamic scholarship to one person. And that person, I mean, I would understand if the school is a major school. Literally, to my knowledge, despite all the journalistic jargon that exists today about literalists and what have you, we don't have in the Islamic world literalist school. The Zahiri passed away long time ago. It's history. Exactly like the Mu'tazilites, the Zahirites, the literalists, does not exist. And this is not something new. For many, many centuries, the Zahirite school existed. Yes, we have those with whom there is we have differences, political differences, but even then, to say that they are literalists, I mean, academically I cannot say that they are literalists. I might condemn their action, but I cannot say that they are literalists. I'm talking about the way they approach the text, and my position is that violence is always contextual rather than textual. People do not flip the book and then they reach the conclusion that, you know, here I am, I have reached a place where I should basically now, you know, do something nasty. That does not, that I read the same books that people read, and you know, you have 1.5 billion Muslims read the same book, and we don't have basically, you know, 1.5 billion people doing things that are absolute and acceptable. In addition, the Amman message highlighted the fatwa of Sheikh al-Azhar that is neither possible nor permissible to declare whosoever subscribes to the Ash'ari creed or whoever practices real tasawwuf, Sufism, as an apostate. Likewise, it is neither possible nor permissible to declare whosoever subscribes to true Salafi thought an apostate. So it goes both ways. So the mystics and the Salafis in that fatwa are on equal footing in being incorporated within the realm of Islam, or in that plurality that is legitimate. Moreover, the Amman message allows room for anyone who falls outside these categories and still accepts the Islamic articles of faith and the pillars of Islam to be included amongst the Muslims. The history of Islam is witness to an ongoing struggle between the Salafi and the Sufi schools. They both exist simultaneously since early Islamic periods. Both schools advocate a link to the early generations of Muslims. For example, Abu Bakr as-Siddiq, who is one of the prominent companions of the Prophet and first caliph, is one of the Salaf to the Salafis. However, the Naqshbandi Sufi order traces its spiritual lineage to Prophet Muhammad through Abu Bakr. So we have basically two major groups, two major schools, who trace themselves to the same person. And they are at odds with each other. And each side claims, you know, the original lineage, if you will. It is generally accepted that the Salafi school was formulated and given prominence by Ahmad ibn Hanbal. So we talk about a couple of hundred years later, after the migration, practically after the Prophet passed away. It's 200 years later. He's also the founder of the Hanbali school of jurisprudence, which is predominant only in the Arabian Peninsula today. By the way, once we hear Salafi, there is a general tendency to think that the Salafi school is the most difficult school because of the way it is portrayed in the media and the use of the word Wahhabism. But in essence, we know as scholars that some issues in jurisprudence are easier in the Hanbali school compared to other schools of jurisprudence. The Naqshbandi order, Sufi order, which is predominant in the Turkish world, was established by Bahauddin Naqshband. Basically, we talk about almost 400 years after the establishment of the Salafi school. The conflict between the Salafis and the Sufis could mean, at times, a vicious crossfire. There are literary works that were published by both sides, rendering each other as infidels. This phenomenon, which is called takfir, is not limited to any specific group. The earliest group that practiced takfir was the Kharijites. And this is, you know, for almost from day one in the history of Islam. In the aftermath of the Battle of Siffin, Muawiyah ibn Abi Sufyan, who later on established the Umayyad dynasty, and Ali ibn Abi Talib accepted binding arbitration. The Kharijites declared both sides as infidels, and the Pandora box was opened. Their deadly campaign caught up with Ali, whom they have assassinated a few years later in the city of Kufa. The Kharijites were very pious Muslims, except that their worldview would not accommodate real politics. Ironically, the people of the book, who were considered protected dhimmis, were safe. And many Muslims, in order to escape death at the hands of the Kharijites, used the narrative that led the Kharijites to believe that they were from amongst the people of the book. The etymology of Salaf, essentially the meaning of Salaf is that which has passed. The Quran uses Salaf in that sense. When used by the Salafis, the meaning is that he who follows the predecessors, the first generation of Muslims, and those who followed their footsteps. There's a hadith of the Prophet in which he praised the first three generations of Muslims, considering them the best of all in the following order. The best of my ummah, of my nation, is my generation, then those who follow them, and then those who follow them. In his commentary on this hadith, in Fath al-Bari, Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani said that the first generation is that of the Prophet's companion. He added that the last of the third generation of Muslims whose generation was accepted lived around 120 years after the migration from Mecca to Medina. So basically within a century. This was the time when the innovations spread far and wide. Innovations meaning alternative narratives, alternative interpretations that did not exist, at least during the first three generations. The return to the understanding and methodology of the Salaf meant bypassing the four major schools of jurisprudence. The Salafis advocated a return to the Quran and the Sunnah. One criticism that I would mention here is that if the Salafis were true to this principle, it would mean a continuous deconstruction of every single new understanding ad infinitum. So, again, Salaf is to go back to the roots, which means that if we have within the Salafi movement today someone, a scholar, who would say, would give a provide a position, so-called his followers or his students or etc. should not accept his position because they also have to go to the same roots to which he also. And this should be an ongoing circle. Zuhair al-Shawish, a contemporary Syrian Salafi scholar, defines Salafism as a method in creed and jurisprudence that includes a return to what has been the case with the first generation. As Salaf al-Salih, the good ancestors, in their belief, their form of worship, ethics and behavior similar to other schools, and that they also belong to some predecessors. Everyone has a predecessor. Muslim, Christian, Jew, even those who go for, you know, fit into other worldviews, they also have Salaf. And this one can say that he or she really just invented the school to which he or she belongs. Otherwise, you have a Salaf. You are Salafi if you have someone before you subscribing to the worldview to which you belong at this particular moment, even if you are atheist. Al-Shawish stated that the Salafis focused on the teaching of Imam Ahmad bin Hanbal. This was the case especially after the Mu'tazilites created the uncreatedness of the Quran, which emerged during the time of Abbas Khalil Ma'un, as I have said earlier. The Salafi Wahhabi connection. Wahhabi is the way it is used in Western media. The Wahhabi version could be considered a renewal movement that took place within the parameters of the same Salafi school. The followers of the school do not refer to themselves using the Wahhabi name, though it is used along with the Salafism interchangeably by others and often in a derogatory way. The Salafis refer to themselves also as Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah, though historically this name was used by others, including the Ash'aris and the Sufis. Most recently it was used by the followers of Abdullah al-Habashi, who was born, he passed away. Most recently he was born in Ethiopia in 1910, but found fertile land in Lebanon, one of their mosques in Bien Bil, a city that I visited often in Switzerland, declared that it's a mosque for Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah. Their official website states that al-Habashi has ijaza from three Sufi orders, al-Rifa'i, al-Qadri, and al-Naqshbandi. In addition, their website has a warning against the Salafis, despite the use of the Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah. Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab himself, talk about some 300 years ago, after whom the movement is named, was born in Uyayna, in the northwestern outskirts of Riyadh. By the way, there were very few, just a handful of people on the outskirts of Riyadh in Saudi Arabia who had a position similar to the Amish. They have rejected technology, but as I said, only a handful of people. And that basically, as a position, did not spread. He studied the Hanbali fiqh at the hands of his father. He also read in the books of two prominent scholars of the Hanbali school of jurisprudence, Ibn Taymiyyah and Al-Muqayyim, who were mentioned by Professor Hanafi. Ibn Abdul Wahhab fostered an alliance with the family of Saud, and soon most of the Arabian Peninsula became united under the latter's rule in what became Saudi Arabia. In this alliance, politics was and still is the domain of the family of Saud. And Salafism became the dominant Islamic theological school, with certain religious offices being allocated traditionally to Ali Sheikh, the family of Muhammad Abdul Wahhab. The traditional political stand of the Salafis vis-à-vis political authority is obedience. This based on a prophetic tradition narrated by Muslim, and the ethos of which is to maintain the unity of the Muslim community and set the line on when the rulers could be removed from power. The hadith requires them to obey Muslim rulers as long as they establish congregational prayers by the benefit its ritual. مَا أَقَامُ فِيكُمُ الصَّلَاةِ. The hadith further requires the Muslim community to tolerate the rulers' personal sins if they fulfill the said conditions. In simpler words, basically Saudi Arabia is a Salafi country. And most people belong to this category, the category where the obedience is the norm rather than the aberration. And the violent acts basically are the acts of the few in this case. Today one can follow a complex discussion of the different interpretations of this hadith. There are those who extend the meaning of مَا أَقَامُ فِيكُمْ الصَّلَاةِ to all political, economic and social institutions of the state, not conforming to Islamic law. It's tantamount declaring the state itself as non-Muslim. This has been the case with the Takfir and Hijra, Jama'a al-Islamiyya. These are groups that use violence against the state and institutions of the state. And those who fall under the general rubric Salafiyya Jihadi, or the Salafi Jihadi movement. Many people attribute the root of this modern phenomenon to Sayyid Qutb's Ma'alim fi al-Tariq, signposts along the road. His description of modern Muslim societies in terms of jahiliyyah, that is ignorance, the state with which pre-Islamic Arabian society was described, portrayed these societies in non-Islamic forms. This category could have paved the road to use violence against the state, but the socio-political context should not be ignored. And I'm now referring literally in my paper to Professor Hassan Hanafi. Hassan Hanafi, a prominent Muslim intellectual who is more of a socialist, stated that had he been imprisoned and tortured like Sayyid Qutb, he would have also written Ma'alim fi al-Tariq. Texts remain the same, context and readers change, and multiple readings follow with different political implications. Thank you.
Thank you. So, who would like to walk into either one of these movements that Professor been talking about, or some other aspect of Islam that you are familiar with,
or
at least images you are familiar with from the newspapers and the media?
What kind of interpretations, and how do you determine whether they are beyond the fence of the gardens of Islam?
For example, if you have something that is absolute, like nothing is like unto him, and I know that human language is big, you know, earthly, not in the sense of mundane, but it's limited by our human experience, then if I represent God, whether in writing or in art, in any 3-4 dimensional terms, then I would know that this interpretation, whether artistic or otherwise, defies that verse that I saw. It is possible to know that which is, you know, that falls within the parameters of Islam, or that which falls outside the parameters of Islam.
Push it a bit different.
So you're using an interpretation of the text to determine what is the...
Yes.
And then there's multiple interpretations of the text.
Yes.
So how does that are you developing a tradition based on conversation amongst each other, if you want? Or
let's go back to the beginning of the article. It was deliberate that I chose that chapter 3, verse 7, about the Quran itself having basically verses that allow allegorical interpretation and verses that do not. For example, if the Quran says fasting during Ramadan, Ramadan is not open for interpretation as a lunar month. We know basically fasting itself is not open, since we have other details from the Quran and also from the Son of the Prophet that say this is fasting, abstinence from food, abstinence from drink, abstinence from intimate relationship between spouses. But there are those who could basically go beyond. If you talk about the area of spirituality, Imam Al-Ghazali said that abstinence could be a higher level, but that it does not exclude the first level. You can say, for example, you can add abstinence of the limbs. One doesn't, you know, abstinence of the tongue. One does not lie, does not, no backbiting, no false witness, etc., etc. Abstinence of the ear, not hearing that which is not proper. Abstinence of the hand, not reaching for that which is not proper. Abstinence of the feet, not walking in the direction of that which is not proper. And he said that there is still a higher degree of abstinence. He said the abstinence of the heart from anything that other than God, in terms of the prayer. So whenever we have a higher, it's like one level is minimum. Then you talk about things that could be added to make it better, to make it excellent, to make it wholesome. But the spirituality, unlike in the case of Professor Hassan Hanafi, spirituality does not exclude in this case the ritual itself. But it builds on that. It improves the ritual. Since ultimately the followers of Jesus Christ and Moses and Muhammad, peace be upon them, all continue to have, you know, rituals until today.
But to pick up on that, then for example, with that interpretation of fasting or whatever, and there are, so if any Jewish or any Christian, you know, does not follow that, then they are no longer people of the book, or they are not within.
They are still people of the book, because from within the Quran itself, the Quran says that the theological message is the same for all prophets, but the law differed somewhat. Now, I cannot talk about the nature of fasting, how it was for the people of the book. But in terms of fasting, it was required. I mean, the Quran says that Muslims are required to fast similar to the people of the book. Similar to the people of the book who did fast like Muslims or did fast point. Probably other way, both interpretations are possible. But the law, for example, the Quran refers to Shabbat. And the Quran refers to Shabbat as being required of the children of Israel. It's not required of us Muslims, but there was something that we call Shabbat, and the Quran refers to some followers of Moses who violated the Shabbat also. So all these are there. So to be a people of the book, now people could be followers of Prophet Muhammad and still make mistakes. People could be followers of Prophet Moses and still make mistakes. But the raison d'etre of Islam does not present itself as a totally new religion. It presents itself as the last phase of the history of revelation, confirming the message that came before.
I think of the the story that we have of the Prophet and his very good companion who brought a case against an orphan about a tree, about a palm tree, I think it was. Was it a palm tree? And the Prophet heard the case and decided that, in fact, this tree was owned by his companion and not by the orphan, broke the orphan's heart. And then I think it was Abu Bakr went to the other companion after a time and persuaded him to accept an orchard in exchange for this one tree, which he then gave to the orphan. And in reading about this a little bit, I believe in the hadith, several hadiths, the Prophet comments on how sad it is that one can hold on to justice and to the law and be right, be absolutely right and within your rights, but you have never had, you will know how it's said, my memory is that you have not been elevated to the level of mercy.
Mustafa, I wanted to elaborate a bit on the whole concept of Salafia that you talked about in a major way. And it seems to me that the English term orthodoxy, like such as Islamic orthodoxy, does reflect the complexity and the multi-layered nature of the term Salafia in Islamic theology and philosophy. And as you well know, Salafia, in its different associations, has not just been an idea in Islam, it has been a practice as well. For example, when the Mu'tazilites, that's to say Islamic rationalists, were upheld by the Mu'tasim Caliphate and the Abbasid Caliphate, Salafia became rationalist and Greek in nature because of the support of the state at the time. So therefore, Salafia is not just an idea, it's a way of life. And it depends to a large extent on the political regime in place in a Muslim society. Now, if we talk specifically about Salafia in Saudi Arabia as a major Muslim country, what we call Wahhabiya, or what has been called since the beginning of the 19th century Wahhabiya, it's very clear that one major feature of Salafia in Saudi Arabia, of Islamic orthodoxy, is that since the end of the 18th century until now, there has been a major alliance between politics and theology in the Saudi Wahhabi state. But in the 20th century, there has been a crisis in Islamic orthodoxy. The main requests came from different sources, one of which is that the Islamic political regime of the Saudi regime, the Abdulaziz regime, was supported by the British early on. And later on, in the name of Islamic orthodoxy, Mecca and Medina were conquered. But that split within orthodoxy or dichotomy or polarization appeared very much in the 1970s and more so in the 1990s when Kuwait was invaded by Iraq and the Americans sent an army to the Arabian Peninsula. And there was a major critique, not from bin Laden was still young at the time, but from a select number of Saudi ulama who were Salafists, of the presence of non-Muslim troops or foreign troops on holy sites, so to speak. It's a critique that was picked up later on by bin Laden himself, but he did not initiate that critique. That's to say that one can diagnose a major crisis in Salafiyya as practice as well as an idea in a country like Saudi Arabia. And bin Laden himself, it's very clear, has come from the womb of Salafiyya himself. He still defines himself as a Salafi, Salafi jihadist, who wants to perhaps capture the Salafi moment in contemporary Islamic history. And in that sense, I would say that bin Laden is a consequence of that crisis of Islamic orthodoxy, but also he wants to rebuild, rehabilitate Islamic orthodoxy in his own way. Would you agree with that type of analysis?
The first part, I mean, 100% I agree with you about the you know, but the there is
where does the first part end?
It's about basically the relationship between the ruling family in Saudi Arabia and the Salafi scholars. And it's, I mean, it's through all the way up to the moment we talk about the emergence of Osama bin Laden. The tendency, I mean, I have a tendency to think that Osama bin Laden does not have really a strong theological or program. Does not have a social program. Does not have a. He has a position. Vis-à-vis the presence, I mean, it started with the presence of the foreign military bases within the Gulf region, including Saudi Arabia. But at no time he tried to advocate, a sophisticated position, not even a sophisticated Salafi position, and probably this is why. This kind of relationship with Ayman al-Zawahiri. So we talk about, again, it's the Ayman is the intellectual in a sense, or the who filled the gap. But I agree with you, and you know that he tries to capture a lost moment or to revive a lost moment. But this is true of every single Islamic movement. Islamic Liberation Party, Hizb al-Tahrir, tries to capture a lost moment. The Muslim Brotherhood tries to capture a lost moment. Even the indirectly, the Dawah al-Tabligh, though they are apolitical, in the dua, in the prayer, in their supplications, one can feel that they also still have that the lamentation of lost moments in the past and the yearning for better conditions, and largely because. It's not basically it's the essential problem. I would say it's the a lost moment when these rulers in the region, whether in the Gulf or elsewhere, they have lost the chance to use oil money, the resources to create a new drive for the region, the economy, the education. In one article that I could not verify, in one article it was stated that the Arab countries literally bought between 1980 and 1990, they bought about 40% of all weapons produced in the world. While we have the UNESCO report a couple of years ago stated that half the Arabs are illiterate. So if we talk about close to 400 million So we have 200 million of us who are illiterate, and two-thirds of the half are women. So illiteracy, also discrimination against women. There is no money, real big money for research, whether in the exact or social sciences. All the project, you know, if you talk about the Islamic reformation from the time of Afghani and Abdo and Ridha and until today, it did not materialize precisely because you cannot only do it as intellectuals. You need also, resources to generate that reformation. So it's not only theological, but there is a context, that a social context that needs to be addressed as well. Yes,
Professor. Why was the writings of Salman Rushdie so offensive to Islam? Perhaps answer.
No. I'm just trying to. In one instance, Salman Rushdie addressed an audience in North America, and he knew how to entertain the audience. By trying to portray Muslims as people who are obsessed with sexuality, and that religion interferes in the area of sexuality. It's true that Islam as a way of life does have something to deal with sexuality, and it's not something alien. Because if you talk about the original biblical narrative, there was a prohibition, for example, of fornication and adultery, which is the case in Islam. There was a in the original text, there was prohibition of homosexuality, and it's the same in the Quran. It has been reinterpreted by subsequent generations in Christianity and Judaism that it's a problem of hospitality, not of homosexuality. And we have progressive Muslims in the United States, a small group that do name themselves as progressive Muslims. They have a book that they published by the same name. It was edited by Omid Safi. And we have a Muslim convert who also tried to reinterpret the problem with the people of Lot as a problem of hospitality, not that of homosexuality. And he dropped the verses that address the problem as homosexuality from the Quran, as much as others drop the, you know, the same text from the Old Testament. So what I'm trying to say is that here, whether it's Salman Rushdie or the progressive Muslims, they have a narrative that is not faithful to the, and to make fun, to poke fun, you know, at the, it's not really about freedom of expression. Like the Elon's post and cartoons, they were not basically the, now he's the late cartoonist. He was not. I don't think that he sincerely wanted to check whether there's a freedom of expression or not. It's offensive, and people get hurt when basically you talk about the prophet. Exactly. Let me put it this way: like the person in Sydney, Australia, maybe about 15, 20 years ago, an American artist, whatever artist means in this case, had the crucifix in urine, three dimensional. If you remember this. And someone got a hammer and smashed the that basically so quote unquote piece of art. Now, I understand the reaction of the person who basically did this, because he got offended. I'm not justifying use of violence, but I'm saying I understand that people do get offended when you mock their religious symbols, when you mock their books, when you mock basically the personalities of their prophets, their signifiers in their own tradition. And the same thing with Salman Rushdie. He had nothing to contribute really. And if it were not for the fatwa of Khomeini, he would be part of the unknown history really. So, and it became kind of a tradition. If you are not really doing well, what do you do? Attack Islam as a writer, attack and you might basically make it. But I have noticed that, you know, it's good that Amazon.com has certain, you know, it has a, you know, it says where the book fits in terms of their, and some of those books that attack Islam, they fare very, very bad. People don't buy them anymore, it seems. They are not interested in this kind of narrative, which is good. So you talk about, you know, people, if they would like to understand what Islam is, they can basically ask Muslims, or basically even, you know, sympathetic non-Muslim professors. We have decent Jewish and Christian professors on of Islam who could basically also address the issue.
One of the, if I could just, a little footnote to this, one of the really striking things to me when I accompanied Ibrahim Aburabi to Damascus in the spring was to realize that, I mean, it's not that I didn't know it. I mean, I knew it in the abstract. But when you are there, to realize how concrete this issue is, the mocking of Jesus Christ in Damascus would get an outrageous reaction. It would simply be normal. And that's where I think the media has so completely failed, or, put it another way, the media drinks so deeply of the kind of silliness of our culture. Silliness of it. That it assumes you can take an extraordinary figure, even if you want to say a figure for a particular community, and you can besmirch it willy-nilly as if it doesn't count. And your point about Rushdie, I mean, I talked with another scholar who we had here some time back, who was involved in reading that book for the publisher, The Satanic Verses, before it came out, and who wrote, he knew Rushdie a little bit, wrote back to the publisher and said, now, this is throwing a bomb in the theater. Do you want that? Does Rushdie want that? He's a bright guy. I mean, he's a Bengali. A 19th century Englishman, but he's a bright guy. Surely he knows what he's doing. Would you like me to talk with him? And the publisher said, sure. And so he corresponded with Rushdie about it and said, you're throwing a bomb in the theater. What do you think Rushdie's answer was? You're damn right, I'm throwing a bomb in the theater. It's deliberate. Mm-hmm. So it's not a free speech issue. Mm-hmm. It's mischief on a global scale.
Talking about throwing bombs in theaters, I mean, you know, you talked about 40% of the world's armaments are bought by Arab nations. The other 40% are bought by Israel. So the Americans are having a great time.
They produce one of the major exports. They export.
But Professor, I just want to say, should we not rise above that, the bombing in the theater? Should we not, for example, Jesus Christ in place in Europe, Christ is greater. It will not touch him if an image of them is, him has been made. He is who he is. He's above that. Another bomb in the theater.
My only response to that, if I can respond, I'm sorry.
No, please do.
Is anyone who does anything in the public square has to exercise an appropriate kind of good sense and compassion towards that public. So.
What I struggle with on this issue is the chap in Sydney who was offended wrote the work of art. Mm-hmm. Those who were offended by Rushdie, by the cartoons, threatened their lives. That, to me, parallels more those anti-abortionist Christians who shoot doctors. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that there is a very small group of people who are that extreme. And the only news I get of this kind of thing is from the media, so it may be inflated, but it appears to me that in the Muslim world there's a larger group of this type of extremists.
Well, if you talk about the camera, it must be a very wide lens to include 1.5 million people demonstrating. You know, that's that the any act of violence. We know for people to demonstrate. I would think to demonstrate. Point. That's fine. To express, their opinions. That's fine. Those who attacked institutions on the way in the demonstration, I have, not only myself, and we have known this for a long time, there would be elements who try to instigate problems by being part of the demonstration, and then they do damages, on the way, which would not be, the act of the people nor the intention of those who initiated the demonstration. But at any rate, there were those who demonstrated, but then there were those who tried to reach out even to the Danes. And the Organization of Islamic Conference held a conference in Copenhagen itself. They tried to reach out. There were individual Muslim scholars who also participated in programs in Copenhagen, and there were programs elsewhere in the Muslim world. But everybody knew that the cartoons were wrong. Now, who learned the lesson? First of all, let me put it this way. The Prime Minister of Denmark could have ended the issue right there had he simply said sorry to the Muslim world. But he started teaching us a lesson in democracy. And that's another, basically, mistake. As if, basically, we have just, came down from the trees. this is how we are treated, really, in certain circles. Now, when in Holland, Geert was about to, publish the movie, immediately, the foreign ministry in Holland, they tried to convince the parliamentarian not to. But when they found, when he was determined to publish the movie, then they said sorry in advance to the Muslim world, and they had a political campaign, and they were going to from one country to the other, simply saying to people, "We are sorry, we tried to prevent this." So it's a big difference between the political establishment in Holland and the political establishment in Denmark. So that's also part of the responsibility.
If I may make a comment about this, this is highly reductive. If one takes the issue of the Holocaust as a major event in modern European history, where 6 million innocent Jews were slaughtered by Europeans, this is a well-known fact that a few people dispute. Some dispute, but they are in the minority. But there's another well-known fact, which is the collaboration between Zionism and Nazi authorities, even within the Holocaust. Now, I myself, as a historian, would not even talk about that collaboration, because that would hurt many millions of Jewish people. So in respect of Jewish dignity, I would not even raise that point, although historically it was valid. So the question here is that we have to make a link between freedom of expression and the dignity of people. Now, Muslims have their own dignity, and no one would do to Jews, let's say, nowadays in Europe, what has been done to Muslims, and what is being done to Muslims. Not because Europeans might be afraid of being accused of anti-Semitism, but because, Jews have been hurt by the Europeans. So the question is, why do they keep insisting on hurting the Muslims? Take the example of Irshad Manji, who was given a chair of moral courage at New York University this past summer, although she does not have a PhD. Now, she has been highlighted by the American academia because she is skillful in attacking Islam and Muslims. Like a mainstream Muslim who respects Islam and Muslims would not be given such a position. So I think that we have to really, you know, as people of faith, we have to be concerned about the dignity of human beings, Muslims and non-Muslims. And that's a very central issue within modern Islamic thought that Muslims have not forgotten.
Others want to respond to this?
Well, yeah, I would like to pick up on the dignity of human beings. How does that translate into a respect for that person's life? What I'm talking about is the extreme reaction of threatening a person's life.
Of certain individuals, that's true. That's true. I mean, that's very wrong to do that. Let's say like the Dutch artist who was killed by an American
guy. Do you remember?
Yeah. That's wrong. But at the same time, you know, what we see in the Western world, we see institutions nowadays in the wake of the collapse of communism, think tanks that are specialized in attacking Islam and Muslims, because the Western world is in need of a new global enemy. And the Muslim world is not looking for a new global enemy, whereas the West is looking for a new global enemy, which has founded Islam since 1989. No one talks about communism nowadays as the new, as a global enemy, whereas Islam, whatever, and their enemy, Islamic terrorism or jihadism or political Islam or radical Islam, has been invented as the new global enemy of the Western world. And Muslims are not the enemies of the West. On the contrary, they wish to have real democracy. The West has supported the most dictatorial regimes in the Muslim world for the past century or so.
Let me add something to this. There's another perspective you can have on this question, which begins to make sense of it, and that is within the framework of racism. What is happening here, whether we're talking about the book that was referred to here, or the Muhammad cartoon, or any of these events, there are strong elements in the West which are attempting to racialize the Muslim world into a single entity. And you see this if you begin to read the newspapers in Israel. It's very clear that the many Israelis see Muslims as an enemy, as a totality, as a unity, and racialize them. And the fact that we are unwilling at the center to, that we are willing to use free speech as an excuse to desensitize ourselves to the Islamic religion rests on the long history of Western racism.
To become a Muslim recently.
He's a recent convert, actually, very recent. He's carrying the weight for Islamic Marxism. Ian.
In some respect, aren't we talking about psychological categories? Because in every grouping of human beings, you have a variety of responses that are possible to events. And you have, I mean, the abortion, shooting the abortionist example was mentioned, the murder of Theo van Gogh was mentioned, the Andre Serrano Piss Christ or Piss Pope art was mentioned. But it seems to me that the response to these attacks is it's tremendously various. I mean, there was a big Vancouver protest to the fact that the Vancouver Art Gallery had the Andre Serrano Piss Christ art. But it wasn't violent. I mean, lots of people showed up. Local artists like Tony Oley, who the late Tony Oley was part of the committee that hired a lawyer, me, to try and get the gallery to deacquisition that piece of art unsuccessfully. But the point is, there was a deeply antagonistic type of art, deeply offensive to a broad community that included artists and religious and non-religious people. There were lots of different religious people who found the art offensive who weren't Catholic or Christian. The protest was mounted at a level of civil discourse that abjured violence. Whereas in these other phenomena, it seems like, and that's why I started off with the psychological category, it seems to me that there's a failure of this recognition of a limit on self, on protests. And I'm wondering whether what we're seeing with these mass protests that turn violent on the streets of whatever city, whatever country, whatever group of people, that there's a psychological immaturity, a incapacity to engage the discourse in a way that refuses to go to violence, murder, and mayhem. How would you respond to that? Because I'm alleging something very serious here. I'm suggesting that if in Islamic populations there's a large number of Muslims who are incapable of taking the debate to the level of civic discourse without violence, there's a problem of cultural immaturity on some level.
There is a Malay concept running amok. It comes really from Malay, and then it made it to English. People suppress, and they keep suppressing. Then they explode. What Professor Hanafi referred to in his lecture about there is lack of dialogue between the oppositions, between the religious and the secular, and then there is lack of dialogue between the state apparatus and these. So dialogue is not the essence. Not only this, but he did refer also, though he spoke about the context of Egypt, but I think this is the same, around the region. There is oppression and there is persecution. The citizen, qua citizen, is persecuted, not because he or she opposes. There's that feeling, it's a burden. So then there is a window opens. And I think here basically it's a moment where all the pressure, rather than imploding, exploding. Now it could be basically it's venting out. So it's not about this particular the particular issue at stake at that particular moment. We talk about a reservoir, okay? But then the dam, just simply there's a, the moment you have one iota, an opening, and then the dam will explode, and then the water will flood. And this is probably what happens in some of these instances. So it's built up, and I agree with you. And had these societies, because in Vancouver, there's a history of resolving things through civic discourse, resorting to law. There is a system where you know that it could, at least it might work. This is why you would try.
Could get a hearing anyway.
So
this is a gloss on Kennedy's, if you make non-violent protest impossible, you make violent process inevitable, protest inevitable. Yeah. That's what you're saying. Yeah. I think there's truth in that. But could you pursue the point you were making about the professor's example, because I found that really helpful. I mean, because he also brought in youth.
Yes.
He talked about the fact that students, and there's something in this immaturity point that I was trying to make, ties in with this, the fact that students tend to throw themselves into illiberal projects quite readily. I mean, right now in Canada, the Canadian Union of Students is endorsing monotheistic propositions like university campuses are pro-choice, okay, and they're shutting down or attempting to shut down pro-life groups right across Canada from having access to student facilities and funding. And these are students full of the vim and vigor of their righteousness of their propositions, and they're now saying there is one university acceptable position on the abortion issue. But this is very dangerous. if those students were allowed to take, if we didn't, in a sense, as mature adults, kind of help the students to see the absurdity of those propositions, then we would have a real problem culturally, because effectively they're attempting to use the mechanisms, in this case of student union governance, to shut down whole positions of argument. The professor's point earlier, I think, was that in societies where you don't have a functioning government, you don't have real elections, you don't have access to democratic pushback, you're going to develop this kind of frustration that ends up becoming violent. So, I mean, I think there are connections that can be made here to problems politically in Islamic countries which have precluded peaceful resolution and encouraged, they failed to encourage civic discourse as a means of even analyzing debates, leading to violence.
Had the governments encouraged the civic discourse, democratic, you know, process, rule of law, transparency, accountability, they would have been sacked long time ago. They would have been replaced. So that's why they did not basically initiate all these things. So it's basically trying to make sure. Look at how long those Arab leaders have been, in power. One example, and he's not the only example, but now he's the dean, Gaddafi has been in power since September 1st, 1969. 40 years. 40 years. He even got rid of his own fellow revolutionary officers. He got rid of them. So he's the only one. He's the up there, and he's not contested. And he created a mechanism whereby you cannot even challenge his ideas, and sometimes they're clownish. And it's just like, but the press loves clowns. they are not interested in serious discourse. They are not interested in serious issues. And you can see sometimes how the discourse is being trivialized. Also, what do they show on these American shows? People are just talking about, McKinsey. I did not know about her except that when she wrote about her affair with her father. Why people are doing things that one day were definitely they could not be discussed in that fashion, and now people can make money out of this, and the discourse have been the systematically a discourse of these trivial things, so in the what kind of discourse we have in that part of the world, anything but the state, anything but the regime, anything but foreign policy, anything but saying anything about the where we are at a specific moment. The West has failed in creating really opportunities for serious dialogue with the people of the region. I'll give you one instance. A couple of years ago, there was a demonstration by the Islamic Liberation Party in Palestine. It's strictly political, but they never run for elections. They don't appreciate any of the regimes in the region, but that's their own business. The thing is, they had a peaceful demonstration in the city of Hebron. The Palestinian Authority police shot at the demonstration, and they killed one youngster. The next day, the same day, Riyad al-Maliki, a Palestinian minister, justified the action of the Palestinian Authority police. He justified the brutality of the Palestinian Authority police. Who is Riyad al-Maliki? He's someone who presided over an NGO in Palestine, an NGO that was paid by Western donors, including the United States, European countries. And that organization was entrusted with teaching, spreading, disseminating, training people how to be democratic and rule of law. And once he became part of the establishment, he defended police brutality. The next day, during the funeral, the Palestinian Authority police shot at the funeral, and the casket fell on the, people were injured. So it's now, they do lead people to radicalize. And I'm, you know, some of the names that I know, they are celebrated in the West as liberals, but they are anything but liberals. It's just like I cannot believe how they could deceive a very large number of people when they defend the most heinous crimes that could happen. So yes, we would love. So this you know, superficial division that if someone is not religious, then he is on our side, then he is good, he is okay, I can deal, I can build bridges with that person, I can... No, religiosity is not bad. Religiosity is good. You know, extreme political positions are bad from anyone, anywhere in the world. But there are roots for extreme political positions. People do not wake up in the middle of the night if everything is okay and then they decide to do something out of the ordinary. Usually that's not the case. Muslim, Christian, Jew does not make much difference. People don't do that. So we need to address the roots of the problems and to reach out with people who have constituency. You don't create an ally. That's what governments do sometimes. You don't basically, you can verify, you would know basically where the decent voice is. And I would say, personally, I think, the thing is, even a person like myself who's studying Islam and I basically discovering Islam at an old age, in a sense, young age probably for some, but I'm still discovering my own faith. It's just like, and I find it really something, there's something so beautiful out there. And I'm trying to share this with people. I'm trying to break the stereotyped image, you know, trying to reach out. And there is, it's very difficult. It's very difficult. And sometimes it comes with a problem. You get attacked, you know, because people sometimes are not listening. Because there is, you know, they are busy with my Scandinavian physiognomy.
I invited him because he's in our week. I know there are several others that want to raise questions, but we need to take a break for 10 minutes and come back to our third speaker, and I'm sure you'll be able to ask your question in such a way as to get both of them to respond.
Thank you.
So there is some juice there, and thank you so much.